this, and now we're recording.
But unplug this and see how bad it looks. Test, test, test. It seems like it, so we don't know. I mean, we can plug it back in.
Yeah.
Better.
Yeah.
One hopes.
Yeah. All right, so this is the third time we have started this little machine for an interview with Winslow Burleson after his 21-day...
Actually, you know what? I just plugged that in a little more. Ha, it might work a little better. After his 21-day Grand Canyon River trip, we are at Peach Springs, Arizona. Now we're going to drive back to Flagstaff. And Wynn was just telling us about the food. And after we talk about the food a little more, we're going to... you're going to tell us who else you saw on the river and what exchanges were like. Then just about, we'll talk about the place in general. And then we'll wrap things up.
Great. I mean, I think the food worked out really well. You know, as I said, everything worked out really well. The only casualty was my sunglasses at Whitmore. I left them at a lunch stop, I guess, by accident or something, you know, on the trail. But other than that, everything stayed with me. Everything worked. I mean, the food worked. It was pretty simple. I used the Whisper Light stove and boiled half a liter to a liter of water every morning for breakfast with either eggs and freeze-dried eggs or oatmeal, little coffee, and then lunch was the cheese or beef jerky and tortilla and dried fruits and chocolate bar or Cliff bar, and then dinners were the soups or mashed potatoes, olive oil, dried tomatoes, and cans of or pouches of salmon or tuna, and lots of nuts, lots of peanut butter. One of the funny things was I ended up drinking peanut butter at times. I was able to sort of squeeze it out of the can for lunch when I was hungry. So that was a new experience for me.
So what would you have done different in the food department?
I think I would have just had a wider variety of the different packages of the soup dinners, and I would have tried them, so I would have enjoyed them better. So I think you mentioned talking about people you met. I met people both before and during the trip, but a number of people have used the these like Indian or Asian food mix pouches that are sort of pre-made dinners, almost meals ready to eat, where you just heat them up. And I think, I'm not sure. Yeah, I think I could have added some of those. I didn't think of other than the pouched salmon or pouched meats. I didn't have any wet food other than that and the oil. I didn't use that much of the oil, but I felt that, you know, the oil, like the peanut butter and sugar, all three of those are very high calories, and having them around and useful was something I wanted to have in my arsenal, but it wasn't something I ended up using as much of, other than, yeah, I got tired of the peanut butter eventually, and I think I still have 2 of the 8 jars left. But I also, you know, so some people in their fanny packs have 6 Cliff bars or so. I threw a jar of peanut butter in there, or sometimes a big 8 ounces of cheese, you know, as an alternative to 1 or 2 of the Cliff bars. I also didn't get into the habit of making lunch, or there was a little bit of challenge in my setup, just from the captain's boxes, these little plastic portable open closed boxes, weren't dry boxes for me. So what I had hoped would have been dry boxes ended up not being dry boxes, and that meant that it was you know, then you're going into a watershed bag or other for your food item, which involves a little bit of de-rigging. And so I ended up eating a little bit out of the safety pouch, so I'd overpack the you know, I'd have to say 6 to 8 bars of Clif Bars, and then I'd eat 2 of the Clif Bars, or, and then every night I'd get into the situation of ensuring that the pouch had the right amount of food for the emergency contingency that it might need to serve. So, so I'd have to replenish it. But that was, that didn't work so well, and likewise on food, I spent a whole day, the second day was a rainy day, very cold. The first day was launching in the snow, and then moving into rain. Personally, I prefer snow to rain. It's drier. And this ended up being wet, rainy weather, and I spent the second day in my tent coordinating and managing the rest of the food, so I knew how much was week 1, 2, and 3.
Where did you camp your first night? Do you remember?
It was just above Soap, perhaps? Or where does Soap? It was like mile 10 or 12, or what's Soap?
Yeah, Soap is going to be
14?
No, not quite that far. Maybe, maybe 11 or 12-ish.
Yeah, so I camped before Soap. When I launched, I was rigged, but didn't feel rigged I could survive a swim, but didn't want a full sort of thrashing swim, and so I wanted a day or a second rigging to go through what we had done on the beach at Lee's to make sure everything was as solid and dry as I wanted it to be. And so I camped before the first rapid. I forgot what stop.
Yep. So was that? So you ran. So, you ran Badger on the afternoon of the first day.
Yeah.
And then right. A lot of flat water down to Soap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I camped just above Soap, and then and I think throughout the trip there was this calculation of how close do I want to be to the next rapid, and how late in a day do I want to run a rapid. I ended up spending an enormous amount of time getting out of my tent and onto the water. At first, it wasn't before, say, noon or so that I would get onto the water. And so I would end up paddling till 4:30 or 5. And I started to learn that given how much time it was taking me, that rigging every day versus the alternative of doing longer days for 2 days and then a day off worked better for me. It also gave me the chance to go on some of Tom's wonderful hikes and occasionally take a second day to. So I had done these 2 hard days of rowing and then 1 hard day of hiking, and that next day I just slept in the tent most of the day. It just sort of all came down. That was maybe on the 6th or 7th day I sort of took a day off where everything sort of just came back together. And I think that was the day that Bruce Klein floated by. I heard this voice around 2:30 in the afternoon saying, "Anybody home? Anybody home?" And I was asleep, so I was just waking up. And in general, I had wanted to be as solo and alone as possible. And I didn't know if this was a park ranger or who it was. And so I ended up just sleeping in the tent. And then a couple days later, ended up passing Bruce, I think just after Phantom. So a number of different things. I don't know if you want to get... Yeah, so in terms of the number of people I met, the first day when it was rainy, this guy came past my tent, saw the boat, and said he was on a 9-day kayak trip with 3 people in kayaks and 2 rafts, and asked if this was the place to scout Soap. And I said it was, and that I probably wouldn't see him again. We both wished each other a good trip. And he ran back and seemed very friendly and super excited. I think it might have still been their first day. So, given that they were only on 9 days, so they, he was just supercharged, like, time to scout the rapid. I guess only one of them was scouting a rapid. They would all take each other's word for it or something. So, that was the first person. And then The next group I had on one of my layover days climbed up one of the peaks. I don't know what camp this was at, but I went on this nice, let's see, if I remember, it was, how do you say it, Kagwant or
Kagwagon?
Kagwagon. And Tom's book on river hikes had some interesting options there. You could go up the wash, up the creek, all the way up to the plateau, or you could go pretty much straight up the wall and then over a little crest and then up a second part of the wall to the plateau up near the crest. And I attempted that first, getting out of the tent around 10 and getting up to the peak around, not the peak, and getting up to that second part of that wall around noon or 12:30, and finding that after two or three of these 8 to 10 foot overhang areas, I wasn't able to do the next one. It was, I mean, I might have been able to do it, but it was more risk and exposure than I wanted to take, and decided to turn around at that point. So what I'd hoped to do was go up on that crest and then see if there was a back way around back to the creek, because it looked like the topo allowed for it, but the guide didn't suggest whether it was there or not. But having not gotten up to the top, that was off for the day. So I got back to the creek at around 1:30 and then ended up going up the creek and enjoying that quite a lot as well. Thinking that if I got up there early enough, then I could maybe at least do the other side, maybe up to the crest from the backside, although that would push it quite a bit. So I enjoyed that long hike and ended up at the upper reaches of the Kagwan watershed for that portion of it. Mm-hmm. And had in my mind this question, I want to see what happens at the juncture between this watershed and the other watershed. At some point, this creek either is going to turn into another creek that goes that way, or, you know, and so I had this sort of intellectual, geographic, geological question in my mind at the same time that the sun was setting. And, you know, it's not setting per se, but getting, you know, the sun afternoon is always setting, you know, so it's getting to be 3 o'clock and then it's 3:30 and then, okay, I have 15 minutes to answer my question. So I go 15 minutes further and, okay, I haven't answered my question, but I can do it 10 more minutes. You know, so I do 10 more minutes of upstream and, oh, I'll go to this, this little bluff. And so I enjoyed myself, you know, with the motivation of this question, and didn't get to answer the question myself at that time, but ended up enjoying coming back leisurely down through that area. Got back to camp around 6:30 or so. And but that day, as I was going up around noon or a little before noon, around 11:30, I saw 15 or 16 kayaks float by, some of them passing up towards my tent, but they were far away. And so that was a second group that I saw. I got back to my tent and continued on. And then one morning, 2 or 3 days later, this was maybe around the 10th or so, 10th or 11th, I saw a larger group. And this was a 16-person raft trip. They were floating by camp, and I waved to them, but didn't really talk to them much as I was packing up. And I passed them at their lunch stop about an hour or two later. Again, I was running one of the first rapids. I forget which, I don't know the sequence that much, but they were very interested to see how I would run that rapid. So they all got up and watched, and I went past and through. And then Well, I went down and I guess scouted it and went in. But the scout was far enough away from lunch that I didn't overlap. And then I spent both an evening and morning at Phantom. And so I got there around 4:30, and I got to the ranger station at 4:45. They were having steak dinner at 5, and I got signed up for the stew dinner at 7:30. So, so I got lucky.
Good job. Yeah.
And I also got signed up for breakfast at 7, which was earlier than I normally was eating breakfast. So, So I got stew dinner. I checked in with the ranger there. He didn't seem to care whether I checked in or not. I gathered they might have different ranger systems for the river group or the Phantom group. So there wasn't really an overlap. But I had told somebody that I would be there on the 13th, so I figured I might as well tell somebody else that I was there on the 13th. And tried the payphone, which was going to be like $40 for a collect call or something. And then I found somebody with a calling card and end up making the call, but it didn't work anyway. So the next morning, had a little bit of text connectivity out on a hike that somebody else had found the only spot in Phantom where there's some texting, and got a couple texts off to my girlfriend and to Tom, and I guess one of the first opportunities to see somebody was at Navajo Bridge, going way back to day one. I was supposed to see Tom there. I ended up there and nobody was on the bridge, and I ended up on a sandbank and took about half an hour, 45 minutes to have lunch. Saw a number of cars go back and forth. Saw two people come over to the edge of the bridge and say, "Hey!" I didn't know if that was Tom or not. Ended up waiting a little bit longer, and then decided that I would head on my way, and hope that it all worked out. It did. So that was the first person. So back to Phantom. Stew dinner, sat next to a Brit from who had done a rally, had been on rally cars and mechanic for 37 years and worked for Ford and had been to the canyon a number of times and had just done a burro trip down with his wife. Maybe about 10 or 12 people in three or four conversations over the course of both dinner and then the 2 hour social hour from 8 to 10. At breakfast, again, another two or three people. It was fun to see everybody starting to debrief and talk about the trip and what was exciting. And a couple of people saw me paddle in and said, "What is this? You don't even have a GoPro, or are you crazy? Are you worried about the rocks? And, are you for real?" These kinds of exaggerated responses and comments. And this one guy commented as I pulled my dry suit out, it's like a birthing experience. And so there was, some sort of camaraderie with people that were enjoying the canyon, which was a lot of fun and good to switch over from a long period of isolation or being solo to having some social activity, and then enjoying it more again being isolated afterwards. Going into Phantom 3 or 4 days out, I thought to myself, wow, this is really interesting. I feel safe because I know that there's breakfast like 90 miles that way. I started laughing at myself about that. So this kind of distortion of time and space and the reality of how isolated or not you are. At Crystal, I camped above Crystal, and when I woke up, there was a lot of helicopter activity, and they were, you know, they seemed to be, they were well below the rim, you know, clearly aware that I was camping there, flying once or twice over my camp where I was still 2 miles away from Crystal. And then I got on the water and paddled down and saw the helicopters more flying up and down, one helicopter, a red helicopter, and it was flying up over the butte by Crystal and then back behind the butte and then back over Crystal, and I got out to scout, and it clearly sort of was aware of me but not interested in me, and I felt that if they were anything wrong with me moving forward. So there was some anxiety with respect to approaching Crystal, thinking that I might encounter some kind of incident or something that might have occurred. And I had also seen a line hanging down from the helicopter, this, say, 200-300-foot line that was had a little pouch or something at the bottom of it. So I didn't know if that was, you know, an emergency supply kit. I think I saw them lower it, or I just witnessed it, and it looked like it was being lowered. But I didn't know if, you know, they were trying to position something or offer me something or any number of situations. You know, I figured they would make it pretty clear that I shouldn't run the river if I shouldn't run the river. But, and so I went ahead and ran Crystal, and it went well. And then they just hung out over this butte for the rest of the time, and I paddled out of the onto the distance. And then I saw this group that I'd passed and passed again, this larger 16-person group, and they offered me some tea, and we caught up. One of the women that I met at the Phantom Ranch had said, if you see a group with a woman named Sierra, say Lois said hello. This will be Canyon Mail. And so I asked if Sierra was in the group, and she was, and Sierra had apparently already run into Lois at Phantom Ranch, so it was a redundant message, but it was kind of fun to see that happen. And then I went on, paddled through that group after having some tea and meeting up with people on the water, and then came around a bend and saw a solo on a cataract raft, and came up and said hello and asked if he was solo and how it was going, and asked his name, and his name was Bruce. And then I said, well, what's your last name? And he said, Klein. I said, oh, wow, I got your book. Bruce Klein had written the book, Never Boat Alone, asterisk, until you've read this book. And or unless you've read this book. And so I said, I got your book. I'm so happy to see you. Because in the book, he kind of mentions that he might not make another trip, that he's been on a number of these, and he's getting older, and they're getting tougher. And so I was really happy to see that he'd gotten back out there and gotten back on the water solo. And he was saying, I'm 62, and I don't know if this is definitely my last trip. But he made that clear in the book before. So, you know, I think there's probably one or two more in him, at least, maybe more. But we had a great time talking about his boat and my boat, and he had been on a trip with the air owner, and this group that I had just passed caught up with us. They wanted to camp at base camp, Bass Camp, and Bruce had already set up at Bass Camp. And so this group took pictures of Bruce and me in front of our two airboats. And so we'll send those pictures off to the air owner. And,
cool.
And we compared our everything, you know, our food. We compared our tent setup. Bruce said he rigs in 2 hours from the time he gets up. I was taking 3 to 4 hours. I finally got down to 2 hours.
Okay.
Toward the end when I was more streamlined, and I think if I had done the food better and the allocation of where my equipment was better, then it could have been a lot easier. So Bruce got a couple good pictures and promised to exchange notes at the end of the trip. He told me about a number of different people coming up and some people doing, not speed records, but fast trips that I might encounter. And at that point, I was a little worried that I wasn't going to get much alone time downriver from Phantom because, you know, all these different groups that I had seen that day and then that I was told were coming up. I was like, okay, this isn't... And then there was a lot of air traffic, and that was sort of, you know, not... Kwagan, or how do you say it? Kwagan?
Kwagan.
Kwagan. There was a lot of air traffic over there. There was more traffic after at Phantom. There was a lot of helicopters coming in and out of Phantom, two or three that morning. And so the canyon was getting sort of less pristine or solo in my experience of it. And I learned that they wanted to go down to Deer Creek, this 16-person group, and spend a couple days there. And I was in a phase where I was able to do one or two long days. And so I got just past Deer Creek and spent my layover day there, but didn't see anybody again for the rest of the trip. In the first part of the trip, there was this sense that I could always look up river and wonder if somebody was coming around. In the later part, I got kind of used to maybe being alone in the lower part. And fortunately, the air traffic also trailed off in that middle to lower section. And so there was more isolation and solitude, which was a very nice experience.
Did you see the... So while you were on the water, today is Monday. Yesterday, Sunday, a solo kayaker completed a 34-hour, 2-minute transit of the canyon from Lee's Ferry to River Mile 277. He would have passed you about 3 or 4 in the morning, yesterday morning. Did you see him at all?
I didn't see him. I was generally... in my tent as early as 6:30. I would cook from my tent and be in my sleeping bag, and I stayed in my tent generally until 7 or 8, so yeah, a good 10 or 12 hours. On some nice nights I would have the tent door open and be looking at the moon and stars. Others were just staying warm in the tent.
Right. And then 3 or 4 days before then would have been another group of 3 or 4 kayakers that, again, would have gone by in a group. And if they weren't making any noise and they did that in the night, they would just paddle right past you and you wouldn't even known it.
Yeah, they might not have known that I was there either.
Okay.
I mean, being...
Sure.
You know, I wouldn't have had any lights on and...
Right.
I would have only had the kayak on the shore tied up, which they may or may not have seen.
Correct. Okay. And they certainly wouldn't have wanted to stop to chat because they were on a mission.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So those people passed you and that was fine. Okay, anything else?
There was one comment. Somebody asked me what rapid I enjoyed the most at Phantom, and one of the things, Sunk Dowager, was one I had remembered from the summer that there had been a change in one of the rapids due to, at the end of our trip, actually we had a lot of water on our trip in the summer, and we had sleet and rain and hail in the summer in August, and some of the major trail work and washouts around Phantom occurred then, and I had forgotten which rapid was the one that had changed. I don't know if it was Ogdollager or not, but I had a sort of cheat sheet to the rapids that we had used in the summer. I forget the name, McLaren or...
Jim Michaud?
Jim Michaud, yeah. And so I had that with Mark Egan's notes on it as well.
Great.
And so I had that both in the summer, although I didn't pay much attention to it because I was just trying to keep up with the group. And this time I relied on that quite a bit and found it very useful. But when I got to Sunk Dowager, I read it and looked at the river, and it didn't line up for me. I didn't like what the notes were saying relative to what I was seeing in the water, and I decided to do what I wanted to do, and was very successful at that. Enjoyed it, and I think that moment, I forget what day that would have been, but probably day 8 or 7, maybe 8 or 9, was a day of sort of enjoyment and confidence, saying, okay, I got this down. I can, even when the information isn't presented, consistent, that I have the aptitude or capacity to make good decisions in my own right.
Cool.
I think that, and then Granite in a big wave, was just a magical experience of, wow, how big this wave is. Just in the bottom of this trough of a wave, and then surviving it, afloat as opposed to a swim, was a huge experience. And then likewise in lava, which I had been swept out of in the V wave in the summer, going into this, it looked, quite different and to some extent less navigable this time than in the summer. In the summer, I understood how the V wave lined up with the next set of waves, and that it was possible in the raft to perhaps go through that second set of waves, even though I got swept out in that second set right above the cheese grater. This one was, I could see doing the V wave, but getting into that second set was not entirely clear that it was going to work. At the same time, it was still the best option. The left side didn't look any better by any means. So I set up, hit where I wanted to on the V wave, hit the second set, and miraculously was still upright, having then found a way to be turned around. And so I went through the cheese grater in reverse, and then just managed to turn back around and get ready for Son of Lava or Lower Lava. Mm-hmm. And that was a real thrill. There was a moment where I was like, okay, this worked, and gave out a yell. And I think lava itself had this whole sort of intimidation factor that it does. It's, say, the last major rapid, one of the bigger major rapids, and then scouting it is in some ways a little bit more the word that comes to mind is staged. It's up there on the cliff, and it's this large set in front of you, and you can see it all, but you don't know how it's all going to go. It's obviously not staged, it's all natural, but you have this, unlike many of the other rapids where you're down and close and can see the water. Here you're seeing the master view and what might happen to you along the entire path. And so I think there's an element of psychology to lava that was also significant to both experience and then to go through and get on the water and understand that this is big water, and that you might flip and might swim, and that's very likely to be okay.
What was the biggest rapid you swam in?
I don't remember specifically, because most of my swims were at the ends of the rapids. What happened for me with the air or the boat was that I would get the boat full of water. It was a self-bailing boat, but it would become full in the rapids. So I was able to hit my lines and do what I wanted to most of the way. But by the time it became full, and then if I wasn't able to keep it pointing head on, I would get sideways and full, and that's when I would flip later in the rapids. Also earlier in the trip, I had more weight high, and so in that condition with the heavy boat and the high weight, later in the rapids, I would swim, say, the last 2-3 waves, and then in the eddy or still in the waves, be able to turn it around and come back up. I didn't swim in any of the big rapids. So, I mean, in the middle of them. I mean, I think possibly in Granite later in the path I swam, but you know, I swam enough in the different smaller rapids that I kind of didn't care as much about it. The swimming wasn't a big factor for me. It wasn't intimidating, and I was swimming enough that it didn't really make sense to record it at that point, you know. So
it's interesting because it just seems like that's a pretty stable boat, and I'm surprised that the waves didn't kick you out, but you got kicked out at the bottom of the rapids.
I think maybe by then I was both full of water, and some of those eddy lines were sort of torquing and, mm-hmm. and pulling.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple swims were, because I hadn't treated the riffle or rapid as a full rapid, and so I was maybe knotting my knee braces, or and then it was like, oh, okay, you want to make me swim, okay, I'll swim, you know, right, you know, it was a read and run, and it was pretty straightforward, and then it was just sort of the last little inaccuracy, if you will, or something catching the wrong way. And, you know, I thought that was okay. I was taking a lot of Bruce's advice and running things pretty conservatively.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly later in the day, after 4 o'clock, I would, know that I was tired and not want to do a major rapid. And then also, if there was a bigger rapid, but not a major one, then I would also cheat it on the inside, or find a way to maybe make it a little less significant.
Yes.
Although some of them are pretty significant. Some of them are, I think, you know, Crystal and Granite were just big, massive sheets of turbulence, and you're scouting them, and you know, you can scout the major features, but there's so much, and some of them are quite long, that it's you can't know how it's all going to go.
So would you go again?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Will you do different next time?
Well, I think the food thing was one. I think the dry boxes were one. Those were two of the I think the logistics for the amount of getting things into camp and out of camp could be optimized. I didn't like that much in the summer, and I found it taxing in the winter. In the summer, I ended up spending a lot of time sleeping on the boats, in part because I didn't enjoy, say, the sand or the unevenness or the loading and unloading of everything. I had everything I wanted all in one place on the boat, and things worked pretty well there. I think if I were to do it alone again, I would maybe want to do something like that, like optimize the raft, you know, push the sort of technology envelope a little and come up with something innovative, come up with kind of a raft platform that could either be anchored or tethered, in an interesting way.
Would you take a raft, or would you take the Lynx again?
Oh, I think the Lynx is much more suitable for a solo, personally. My issue for a solo was I don't like the idea of not being self-sufficient in terms of being able to recover from a flip. And as you get towards a raft, you're getting into situations where you have potentially more payload or heavier stuff, harder to flip the raft, much harder to recover from. So I wanted to be very self-sufficient on that front. I still would want to do that. I mean, if it were a raft, I would want to go with a, you know, almost a an air style raft, like a very, very lightweight, you know, like, I mean, I think a raft is fun, but I think, to be honest, the Lynx was a lot of fun. You're down in the water, you are, I think once you experience the water, it is a lot of fun to be in the water. And after a while, some of the what would have been fun at the beginning of the trip was not quite as fun, because we've seen a lot of it, and you know, it's not as big as some of the big ones you've done, and you know, and it's like, okay, there's another medium rapid before a big rapid, right? You know, so you know, I think one of the things I would like to do on another trip would I think having a non-solo trip would be interesting, because I would probably want to do it in the air or a solid kayak, a hard shell, because in that situation you would have the backup that you don't have as a solo trip, where you would be able to play with some of the harder, more aggressive elements of the water to a greater extent than you might on a solo trip. And so I think that contrast of enjoying all that the water has to offer in a trip would be something I'd want to look for in a future trip. But I think either a solo or a trip of that nature where you're able to either be in the ducky or the hard shell would be of interest. The ducky was great for as opposed to a hard shell, for a longer trip, because you have a lot of room for storing lots of stuff, and you also have a lot of room to relax it. You can sort of stretch out or lie down and still be on the water. It's a platform as opposed to a single sort of universal joint, if you will.
Right, that you have to load up and then you have to work yourself into.
Right.
Seal yourself up in.
Right.
And
then
very
endure the fatigue or constraint of your muscles and legs.
Sure.
So, you know, I don't know that at this time I would have the flexibility or pain tolerance for a hard shell for that duration. I just haven't been in a hard shell for that period of time for a long time. I think a hard shell would be pretty difficult for me, as opposed to the ducky. But the ducky has all the advantages. I'm not sure, other than more equipment, what the advantages of the raft would be, you know, for a solo trip. I know Bruce likes the cataraft. He had an air cataraft. And
do you know how long it was?
It was a little... So mine was 12. I think it was like maybe 16, 15. Yeah, you know, I think he was on a longer trip. He was carrying all his own water. So he had water for the entire trip. He had... it was a 30-day trip, and he was like at 20 or like 20 gallons or something, you know. So, but he, I mean, these were sort of different styles and different experiences.
Okay. Anything else before we wrap things up?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're thinking about it, I would definitely figure out how to do it. And I would also say that one of the very impressive things is the number of people that are willing to help and help you figure out how to do it and what's right for you. Are, you know, as you commit to doing something, the forces conspire to make it possible. And I think that's a huge lesson that I'm going to take away from this towards things that I want to do next. You know, just as you get closer, getting help from Tom, getting help from Bruce, getting help from local, you know, from Stewart, the guy on the Lynx One, from a local solo kayaker in New York who loaned me his dry bags. All of these people, and then, you know, from the summer trip, all of the people on the summer trip giving and participating and sharing their knowledge. People on the summer trip who had done solo trips before helped me think about whether this was possible and what it would be like. The dry suit salesman, you know, helping me understand the merits of one or the other dry suits and what additional equipment and insulation you want to have. All of this learning and putting things together and making things possible was very, very helpful.
Cool.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, thank you.
Thank this you is, for making it. You've been, you know, so generous with these shuttles and all your information and inspiration.
Fun. This is part of the Grand Canyon Historical Society oral history interviews. Today is January 26, 2016. This has been an interview with Winslow Burleson and Tom Martin at the end of Winslow's 21-day river trip through Grand Canyon. We've been driving back from Diamond Creek back toward Flagstaff. So that ends this, what will be a three-part interview. Take a look at this. And it's still chugging away, so
probably good.
Grab that and hit that red button and turn that off.